Morning, everyone. Sorry for the late start, but we're going from Karl Rove to Janine Benyus, or otherwise from the ridiculous to the sublime, I like to think. But I'm Joel McCower from greenbiz.com and Clean Edge. One of the great joys of my life in the 20 years or so in which I've been working in the areas of sustainable business practices and clean technology is getting to know a core of people who have become not just my friends, but my teachers and my mentors and my heroes. Certainly, the very top of that list is Janine Benyus. Not going to do much of a bio. Janine, you have whatever information you need to know that she's not going to tell you, but Janine has elevated the already noble cause of nature writing and interpretation and storytelling to an extraordinary place through her coinage of the word biomimicry and the power that is bringing to a new generation of designers and industrial types and companies and communities and just the inspiration that we all get out of that. So if you heard, if you were at the Belly Up last night, you heard a little bit of the incredible work she's doing. I'm just thrilled to have her here. We tried and worked and succeeded to get her here at Ideas Festival. Before we get to Janine, though, just a little bit about you. How many of you are in the design the design field or the creating products of any sort? Really quickly, anyone want to just quick, just like two words or three words, what kinds of things you're doing?
Online services and websites.
Okay.
Marketing stuff.
Okay.
Sculpture.
Sculpture, right.
Building materials.
Marketing. Great. And jewelry. And others of you in other education field, nonprofit world, just good. Okay. What am I missing? Science.
Medicine.
Sorry.
Medicine.
Great. Okay. The last thing I'll say about Janine, she's going to talk for 30, 40 minutes or so, and then we're going to sit and have a little bit of a conversation, and of course with all of you. If you ever in your life are lucky enough to take a hike in a forest with Janine, strap on your boots as quickly as you can. I had that privilege a few years ago, and it was an extraordinary experience. Not only will you come away from that with a better understanding of just the natural world, but the better understanding of all of our worlds and where we're coming from and the processes and the ways that we live and the way society works. It's an amazing opportunity. So I hope that I think you'll get a taste of that in a minute. So please join me in welcoming Janine Benyus.
Thank you, Joel. We should go outside right now. I'm the official representative of the No Engineer Left Inside program. It is a privilege to be here with a group of people who would spend the time of your lives discussing really what the world needs now. And what the world needs now, in addition to a lot of love and compassion and wisdom at this point, are some really good ideas, fast. And what I'd like to talk about today is a place to look for some ideas that are not new, that are actually very, very old. They're new to us in Western industrial culture, and they're invisible to us increasingly, because they reside in organisms and ecosystems that don't necessarily look like us. So I'm going to talk about the ideas of the chlorophylled and the exoskeletoned and the furred and the winged and the four-legged and the single-celled, who have been here far longer than we have. And their ideas, as E.O. Wilson says, have been burnished by not just millions of years, but billions of years of R&D on the same planet on which we're trying to invent things that will allow us to stay here. We are surrounded by genius. This is I live in the Bitterroot, luckily enough, and that's where I live. These systems, I went to school to learn about these systems. And I learned about them. And there is quite a difference. There's a different muscle that's used. There's a different kind of stance. There's a different set of questions when you're learning about something than when you're learning from something. And biomimicry really is about that profound switch between not just learning about, but learning from these organisms. So put yourself into these settings. If you're a snorkeler or you want to walk on that beach, walk on that prairie, put yourself in that setting. And what I would suggest to you is that these are high-tech manufacturing zones. There are hundreds of thousands of chemicals being made every single second silently, and you need no gas mask to go in there. There are miracle materials being made. You need no hard hat. There are homes being built. There's water being filtered. There's water being pumped silently. There are young being cared for. These systems are, I now realize through working on a book called Biomimicry, I now realize that these are the most elegant and high-tech technologies that we could possibly imagine. We just are not in the practice of looking at them that way. But what I'd like to show you and tell you about are people who have made that their practice, designers, engineers, architects, inventors, who have realized that these survivors have learned what works and what lasts here on Earth. This dragonfly, amazingly, has a sensing apparatus that is able, they feed on mosquitoes. When a mosquito zigs, the dragonfly zigs with it so precisely that all the mosquito sees is the dragonfly getting larger and larger and larger. And the mosquito, of course, is tuned to react when there's something moving out of the edge of its vision. So when something's just looming, it never sees it. Now you can imagine the sensing apparatus of this dragonfly that is able to do that. Some folks at Berkeley have now created a camera based on the 10,000 lenses of the compound eye of this dragonfly. As E.O. Wilson reminded us, 3.8 billion years of R&D, 10, perhaps as many as 100 million species, probably more, if we think about the microbes, their survivors and their solutions are judged by a different criteria than the solutions are products that we put into market. They are successful because they're well adapted to where they are on Earth, for what they need to do at the time they need to do it. And designers and engineers are now trying to come to the point where their solutions are better adapted. So as you listen to this, no matter what field you're in, this is not just, I think we're all designers. I think we're all designing something. We're redesigning our world. We wake up in the morning, we make a lot of choices about what to buy and what to drive. That's a design decision. Whether you're literally at the design table designing a car or designing what lives or dies in the next generation in the market, you're still designing your world. So if you were to ask nature one question to help you make those decisions, to inform your decision, what would it be? This is a picture from a trip. These are the kinds of things that there's a group of biologists called biomimicry guild that has come out of this work. And what we do, literally, is sit at the design table with engineers and tell them how life works, because they're interested in biology, in bio-inspired design, but they don't know how biology operates. They don't know how life works. So sometimes we're lucky enough to get to take them places. We went out with a group of wastewater treatment engineers called Corollo Engineering, and they make the water purification systems, for instance, in the city of San Francisco. That's a Corollo-designed engineering system. We went to the Galapagos Islands with them, with their head engineers, in a boat for 7 days. And it's very, very typical of when people say to me, why aren't we looking to the natural world for inspiration? I tell this story. We were on the boat, and the first night there was a lot of resistance. They were sort of walking around like this and sort of looking right past me, and I thought, uh-oh. So I just kind of whistled and said, hey, what is going on here? And they said, well, you know, we already do biomimicry. And I said, what do you mean? And they said, well, we use bacteria to purify our water. And I said, okay, well, that's bioprocessing. That's something we've done for a long time. It's a bio-assisted technology, like using yeast in bread. But biomimicry is a little bit different. It's about asking the advice of an organism or looking for its recipe or its design, getting an idea rather than actually dipping an organism. Slightly different take. They said, well, what do you could possibly learn from the organisms in the Galapagos Island? I said, well, what do you do for a living? Give me a verb. Give me a function. And they said, well, we filter. We separate out something from water. And I said, okay, well, let's see if we can find any filters. Let's go snorkeling. And we saw lots of filters. In fact, we saw amazing filters. Most of the organisms that we were swimming with were in some way or another filtering oxygen out of water or filtering solutes out of a fluid. They were filter feeders. All different kinds of filters. So they started to get the idea of this. And they said, I said, okay, well, what's another? Give me a problem statement that you have. And this is how biomimicry works. And they said, well, we have this thing called scaling. It's the same thing you have, a mineral buildup inside your pipes, in your home pipes. You know, when minerals build up, they call it scaling. And it's really energy intensive in the sense that they either have to dig up the pipes when the aperture becomes too small because of the minerals, or they flush it with toxins. So it can be toxic as well. And so they said, well, what in the natural world could help us with this? And so we went walking on a beach. And I picked up a handful of these shells, and I said, well, what's the mineral buildup inside your pipes? And they said, it's calcium carbonate. And I said, well, that's what these shells are. They're calcium carbonate. And they said, okay, well, how do they form? And I said, well, it's very similar to a scaling process in a sense. I mean, this is a picture of that beautiful mother of pearl on the inside of abalone shell. This is mother of pearl forming out of seawater. So it's a crystallization process, basically, out of seawater. So it's very similar to what's going on inside the pipe. So one of the engineers said to me, well, if it's basically a self-assembly process and it's crystallizing automatically out of seawater, then why aren't shells infinite in size? Which was a really good question. And I said, well, because they're able to stop that crystallization process. Well, at that point, they all just sort of came in towards me. And you could have heard a pin drop. And they said, how do they do it? At the moment when they realized that what they do as engineers and the problem they've been trying to solve their entire professional lives, that there might have been a 300-400 million year old organism who has solved it. And indeed, they have. What they do is to start the crystallization, they release proteins into the water that act as a template, and the crystals come down and they form the shell. But then they also release other proteins that stop the crystallization. They're called stop proteins. And there's actually, down here I'm going to put actual companies that are now making biomimetic products. So Dunlar is a company, that, and the product is called TPA. And it's a non-toxic way to coat the inside of pipes. You allow some scaling, and then you stop the scaling. They didn't know this. And the whole week changed after that. It was really quite amazing. They were like little seven-year-olds running around, Janine, on their hands and knees, and they became naturalists. It was fun to watch. So it's the conscious emulation of life's genius. Many people have come up, like Buckminster Fuller and Leonardo da Vinci. It's come up a little bit in the past, and it's popped up, and now it's becoming more systematized. I'm going to talk about some of the levels of biomimicry, and this is the mimicry of hairdo. And that's the first level, and Al's trying to work on that owl look. But here are the three levels that I found going on. And since the book came out in 97, I've really been following this story, and this story has been following me. And it kind of breaks down into these three groups. One is mimicking form, which is just shape, and I'll talk about all three of these. It would be like mimicking the hooks and barbules of that feather in order, say, to make a fabric that didn't need a zipper, that you literally, the way birds' feathers hook back together, with their, they use their beaks. It's the way their feathers are shaped. Those hooks and barbules zip back together naturally. So that would be mimicking form. But the key thing in moving towards a more sustainable society is to make sure that how we make things, we change. How that owl makes that feather is what's called now, there's an effort to become more like nature's chemistry. It's called green chemistry. So mimicking process, or how is it made, is in the realm of green chemistry. And there's an effort afoot to replace the industrial chemistry book, industrial chemistry recipes, with nature's recipes. So when you look at oxidation reactions and how we do them in industrial chemistry, replace those with perhaps how fungus do oxidation reactions and break down wood. Okay. The next level is even harder. That's the level of looking at a whole ecosystem, like a coral reef or a forest or a prairie, and say, how does that system manage to enhance the place where it is and make the most of what it has in place, where it has to live for hundreds of years with a set amount of materials, abundant energy coming in, but a set amount of materials? How does it reuse and reuse and reuse that material? It's looking at the forest as a model and remaking our economy based on that model. It's called industrial ecology. And that's that's harder. But all of these, I think, are necessary before you can truly say you're coming towards a biomimicked product or process. So what I've done is divide up some of these case studies. I'm going to run through these case studies. I'd rather give you breadth at this point than depth. So I'm going to run through the case studies quickly so you have an idea, you have a sense of the spectrum of things going on in biomimicry. There are many labs, and these are just a few of them. There are many, many labs, dozens and dozens of labs, who are working on looking at leaves as a model for a new kind of solar cell. Okay, and the Arizona State University group that I talked about in the book, their goal is to actually mimic, and they have mimicked, the photosynthetic reaction center, life central, basically, inside a leaf. And they've mimicked that in that 10,000 atom assembly in a very simple five-part molecule that gets excited by light and that moves a negative charge to one end of a molecule and the positive charge to another end of the molecule. Their goal, and holds them apart for long enough to do work, their goal is to create sort of a molecular-sized solar battery, So as they envision it, the first use will probably be to do chemistry in water, in small little bubbles called liposomes, with a power pack, and do chemistry in those tiny vesicles powered by light. It's a very crude and simple mimic of how photosynthesis works. Another goal might be at the point where we can reproduce these, create these in our labs, we could mix them into paint, for instance, or coat the highways with them. It's the size of the, make ubiquitous solar cells. The technology that's come out from this work that you can buy today is called a dye-sensitive solar cell. And again, many, many labs are at work on this. That's note the et cetera. This is using basically a very different kind of approach to photovoltaic cells. And you can, and they're cheaper. They don't, they're not as efficient. They work better in low light. They're certainly not as efficient, but they are a lot cheaper. I just talked to the managing director of Dysol, and she said 6 years ago, there were about four or five labs doing dye-sensitive solar cells. There are now 1,000. So this work is really growing. Coating something like dye-sensitive solar cells or even traditional PV cells, we might be looking to the moth. There's a company called Autotype that has made a thin film covering for solar cells. And what it does is it light comes in, but it doesn't bounce out. It's called an anti-reflective coating. You want as much light as possible to gather solar energy. And moths, that's a moth eye, moths want to do the same thing. They're night predators, and yet there are predators looking for them. So they don't want light shine from their eyes. They don't want to be detected. And so light comes in, and they have the structures, the pillars on their eyes actually trap that light. And that has been mimicked exactly into a film that Autotype has come out with. Fuel cells, one of the reasons they're so expensive is the platinum, the membranes. It's what's interesting about a fuel cell to me, while it's a very, very high-tech, to us it's a very high-tech piece of equipment, the basic functions going on in a fuel cell are going on in organisms all the time. In different organisms. For instance, a fuel cell breathes in hydrogen and it breathes in oxygen, and at the membrane level, and then it becomes hot water and electricity, at the membrane level, there's some chemistry that goes on to take that hydrogen, hydrogen and that oxygen and to smoothly combine them. There's chemistry. This is a cyanobacteria, one of the oldest organisms we know of, who does that same sort of hydrogen chemistry. On the left is an actual molecule of what's called the hydrogenase. It's an enzyme that does that chemistry. And on the right is a mimic of that molecule. The scientists at John Innes Center, when coating the membranes with this molecule, are finding that they can have a performance that is as good as the platinum catalyst membranes in a fuel cell. And, of course, very, very inexpensive. Again, our lungs might be contributing to fuel cells. The study of optimized branching structures in the natural world. Every time you breathe in, there's fluid or gases, and how they flow, it's the same sort of branching laws, mathematical branching laws. You'll find in lungs, you'll find in tree leaves, you'll find in your own veins. When applied to, this is Morgan fuel cells, when applied to a fuel cell, what's called a bipolar plate, they were able to increase peak power on a fuel cell by 16%. Again, unusual sources of inspiration. You may not think of a whale as helping you with wind energy. I love this. There's something about nominal determinism in the natural world. I mean, in natural sciences. Frank Fish actually studies a mammal. He studies these humpback whales, and he now has a company called Applied Fluids Engineering. He looked at the scalloped edges of a whale's flipper, and he thought to himself, the whale is such a maneuverable animal, especially when they're doing that bubble feeding, where they come up in a spiral blowing a bubble, and then they create a cylinder of bubbles which trap fish, and then they come back under and they turn around with their mouths open. It's a fabulous event if you've ever had a chance to see it. Those scallops on its flippers are actually giving it amazing maneuverability. When Frank Fish made an airplane wing model that was smooth, like ours are, and a scalloped airplane wing, put it in a wind tunnel, and found that there was 32% less drag with the scallops, which is huge. If you're at Boeing, I gave this talk at in Seattle once, and literally a Boeing engineer sort of rushed me. I felt like I was at a rock concert. During the talk, just came up with his card like, hi, I need to know. Because 32% is amazing. And there's a 6% increase in lift. And you can go into a 40% steeper angle before stalling. So in an industry in which we're, you know, talking about percentages, imagine if there was a 32% less drag on your airplane that you came here on. That's a lot. Now, putting it on a wind turbine is the thing that they're looking at now. So let's look at water, because we've been talking a lot about that this week. How will we procure it, and then how will we purify it? Procuring water, we always think of digging a well, maybe getting salt out of water. There's a lot of water in the air. And this is a beetle called the Namibian beetle. And you see those little bumps on its wing scales? Those are shaped in a particular way, and they have a particular chemical profile. What that organism does is, in the desert, it's got this fog that comes through, this evective fog. And the fog's going at 50 miles an hour. So in order to drink from the fog, it lifts its wing scales. And the bumps, the tips of the bumps, have water-loving tips. And the sides are water-shedding. And a ball starts to build up, ball of water, and then it goes down the chute into the critter's mouth. Okay, very simple. This is what you find in the natural world. It's over millions and billions of years, this evolutionary elegance. There's a company called Kinetic that has mimicked this and is putting it now as the sides for desert refugee camp tents and sheets in arid areas to allow agriculture. It's four times better than our fog collecting mesh nets that we have. So this is just one. Here's another. This is both bio-inspired and bio-assisted. This is Dean Cameron of Biolytics. And what he's done is look at how the soil column near a riverbank works to filter water. And what he's done is create a very small septic system. The company's called Biolytics. It's in Australia. A very compact and 50% cheaper. You can see all the stats there. Small septic system for homes. And what he does is he invites in soil organisms who then create a humus filter for him. They create sort of a sponge. And then the water's filtered through that. And then irrigation water is put out into the yard. I know we have a lot of rain today, but this is really going to be necessary for the West. So again, what he's done is mimic the pattern of a soil ecosystem. How about other raw materials besides water? There's one way of procuring raw materials. I think increasingly we're going to be needing to mine our landfills and our smokestacks. I think there's a lot of material out there already. Metals, for instance, are abundant in water, but we don't think of it as a mining operation in water because they're so dispersed. But a lot of organisms have what are called chelating molecules. They scavenge metal out of water very, very efficiently. And a lot of microbes do that. So there's a company called MR3, and as I mentioned, this is not about using the bacteria to do this. What they've actually done is mimic the different molecules a particular microbe will be really good at pulling a certain kind of metal out. So they mimic that molecule, and they coat a filter with it. And there's imagine a waste stream coming out of a landfill or out of a manufacturing plant. They make a bread box that has different filters in it, each coated with the molecule to chelate, to scavenge out a certain kind of metal. So what they basically have is a mining operation in a box. And they pull out those filters, and they're able to recover recoverable amounts of metal. A whole different way of thinking. This is one of my personal heroes. This is Jeff Coates, who was one of the youngest, one of the top 100 scientists to watch in the coming century. There's a holy grail in chemistry, and it is to just be more plant-like. Plants take what is the wood on the top of this dais made of?
Cellulose.
Right. And what is that? Where does this carbon come from for that cellulose? What's their raw material? Plants. Carbon dioxide, which is what? The poison of our era. Plants don't think of it as poison. And what they do is they make long chain molecules out of it. But we haven't, and so people have always said, well, why can't we make plastics, long-chain molecules, out of CO2? Well, CO2 is notoriously non-reactive. That's why it's in fire extinguishers. Plants have a way, they have enzymes, they have ways to speed up these reactions. So Jeff Coates of Cornell found a catalyst that speeded up that reaction. He now has a company called Novomer. Check this out. Any of you who are investors, please. This is an amazing technology. Biodegradable plastics, making polycarbonates like you have in your glasses, and thin films out of carbon dioxide. And they're biodegradable at the end of their life. Seems like solving two problems with one idea. Borrowed from plants. Another place we're getting raw materials are bio-based carbohydrates. We're starting to go to agricultural residues. You've heard about biostarches. And that's a great way to go in that you can compost the product. At the end of its life, you can have it composted, right? And so we're happy about that. We're excited about that rather than plastics, oil-based plastics. We're happy to be going to carbohydrates. But, you know, I fear we're rushing headlong into a new fossil resource. This rootlet is the new oil rig. And our topsoil and the fertility within that topsoil is the new fossil resource that we're going to be pulling on. We have got to get, if we're going to carbohydrates that are grown in our crops, are grown on soil, we have to get really good at agriculture really quick, because we're not only going to agriculture for our food now, we're going to go to agriculture for all our stuff. And we're going to go to agriculture for our biofuels. The question is, the new oil well is soil fertility. So everybody's got to be really, really good at farming. And the question we ask about our products has to be, how are they grown? And this is how most of our crops are grown in the United States, in our plains area. They're annual crops, and they're in monocultures. So you dig them up every year, and you put one plant, the same species for miles, which means you lose a lot of soil during that digging it up. It bleeds away into the Mississippi. It's a lot of fertility. So you add an oil resource. You add fertilizer, which comes from natural gas. And then you've got one species for miles, so pest, it's an all-you-can-eat pest restaurant. And so you put on pesticides. That's another oil product. and herbicides. And David Pimentel of Cornell says it's 10 kilocalories of oil for every kilocalorie of corn. And a bushel of topsoil going down the Mississippi, 6 bushels of topsoil, for every bushel of corn in Ohio. Okay, these are scary when you're talking about a fossil, what I would consider a fossil resource, because bringing back soil fertility of the depth that we have it in the prairie, the ex-prairie region, is way beyond our human lifetimes. So what's the alternative? Prairies, when biomimicry always works like this. What was there before we got there? And can we learn anything from the patterns that were there before? And prairies, the amazing thing about prairies is that, one of the amazing things, is that incredibly deep root level, root zone. Not just deep, but varied. Each of those plants has a different root composition and length. And so they're kind of using a different part of the environment to get their needs met. They also, and they're perennial, they stay on the, you know, they stay on the soil. So you're not losing that soil every spring. They also are a polyculture. Instead of an annual monoculture, they're a perennial polyculture. Lots of different species with different ways of using that habitat. Land Institute, Wes Jackson, has been working tirelessly on this for about 25 years. What they're trying to do is turn our crops from annuals to perennials, to breed perennialism back into our crops. They used to be perennials. We bred them into annuals so we could carry the seeds in our pockets. Trying to breed perennialism back in and to plant our crops, our perennial crops, in mixtures and then harvest them at different times a year. Very interesting work and really pretty essential. Manufacturing. This is Joanna Eisenberg's hand. She's at Lucent Technologies, what used to be AT&T. And you see those little filaments at the base? This is a sea sponge, Venus sea basket, it's called, or Venus sea flower, I believe it's called. And those filaments at the base there are, they work as well as our fiber optics. But what's interesting about them is that you can tie them in a knot. So unlike our glass made at Corningware fiber optics, these you can tie in a knot. The other thing that's amazing is the way they're manufactured. Okay? This is the way we manufacture things. The recipe is called heat, beat, and treat. Heat it up, high pressures, right, and treat it with chemicals. That's our recipe that material scientists use. But we can't, life can't possibly, the sea sponge can't possibly do that. So it's found a different way. This is a picture of, thanks to Dennis Kunkel, a picture of a spider's, business end of a spider. Those are the spinnerets, and that's silk, color enhanced, that's silk coming out. When this spider manufactures, it can't do what we do with Kevlar, which is heat petroleum up in sulfuric acid to 1,400 degrees and then draw it out at huge pressures. But it's found a way to make a fiber that's 5 times stronger ounce for ounce than steel. Silently, and to do chemistry in water rather than a solvent like sulfuric acid. So this is what I mean by green chemistry. Borrowing the recipe of this organism, and I don't mean taking its gene and sticking it into a goat, which is what's happening at a company called Nexia. Take the gene from the spider, you put it into the goat, and you clone the goat. The goat milks out spider silk from its mammary. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that. That's domestication. That's a bio-assisted technology. Biomimicry is doing the hard work of figuring out the recipe and the chemical processing, and doing it yourself. It's not easy. This is not easy, but it's happening. Here's on hard materials, here's the abalone shell again, and the mother of pearl, the nacre. This is a picture of it self-assembling. Those are the layers of protein. The yellow is the layers of protein, and the blue is the minerals. Layers of protein actually template. This is outside the critter's body, between the soft body and the shell. It templates this particular kind of crystallization. So this is existence proof. Oh, by the way, this is twice as tough as the high-tech ceramics we have in jet engine ceramics. Twice as tough. So this is Jeff Brinker at Sandia. He's just amazing. And work is also going on at these universities and many more. Again, Princeton and lots of universities. This is a picture of, on the left there, he's creating self-assembling ceramics out of a beaker of water. He's doing optically clear glass. It's a coating technology at this point. There's no heat. He dips something into the liquid beach sand, basically, the precursors of glass, and an organic and a detergent to herd them all together. He dips it in. He pulls it out. As it evaporates, the molecules self-assemble. They jigsaw together into layers of glass, separated by a soft layer. There's hundreds or thousands of layers of optically clear glass. A completely new way of making ceramics. This is a bullet going into another mimic of the abalone shell and being stopped by it. These are diatoms, the shells of diatoms. And their skeletons are made from the glass family, the silicates. And silicon is also in that family. That's what we make our computers with. Only when we make them, there's a lot of carcinogens involved. The folks at UC Santa Barbara and Princeton have been working to do what's called biosilification, which is a mimicry of the way glass-like structures are formed in the ocean. And they have actually been able to do that. Now the question is, can we make something with this kind of architectural elegance? This is Haeckel's. You guys, any artists in here know about the book Art Forms in Nature by Ernst Haeckel? I mean, if you ever have a chance to buy one of those, buy them. They're amazing, these big prints of nature's actually architectural wonder. And structures, if you look at that second layer there on the left, there was actually a structure in Paris for one of the exhibitions that looked very much like that. But these are Radularian. These are actually organisms, or they're skeletons anyway. Here's one we've been working on for a long, long time in the scientific community. I don't mean me personally. The glue, the underwater glue of mussels. We can't even keep a Band-Aid on our finger in the sprinkler. And this glue has finally been mimicked by a Professor Lee at Oregon State University. And Columbia Forest Products is now making a plywood adhesive that is completely waterproof and has no formaldehyde in it, mimicked from that. Organisms adhere in a lot of different ways. Here's an organism that adheres without glue. That's a close-up of the bristles that come off the fins of a gecko. And it's how a gecko sticks to the charges. Positive and negative charges in a wall. Wall is charged with little nooks and crannies. And those bristles actually adhere through what's called van der Waals forces, which is a very, very, it's the minimal attractive force. And yet when you add it by the millions, you can suspend about 280 pounds from a fully engaged gecko. Okay, that which is amazing. And that's why geckos walk like this. They have to actually peel their foot up. They couldn't pull like this. They have to peel it. When you peel it at a 30-degree angle, you release that. So the idea here is, what if we could put our products together, product like this, not with glue, because when you go to recycle it, it's contaminated by the glue. What if you could put it together with gecko tape? So you buy a product like a computer case, and it's put together on the edges with Gecko tape. And then you send it back to the manufacturer, and when they go to recycle it, they're able to pull it apart. That's what I mean by design for disassembly. And it's actually been mimicked. This is a group at University of Manchester. They were actually going to use a graduate student hanging from a flagpole outside, but the university insurance found out about it. And so they just did this little Superman guy. But a piece of dime-sized Gecko tape could suspend a liter bottle of milk. That's about the strength of it. And then it's releasable. So the question, you know, this kind of sort of changes the game. It's not a question of how do we reduce the toxins in commercial adhesives. It's how does nature adhere? There's lots of different ways nature adheres. This is one organism. This is a picture from Stas Gorb's collection of insect feet. There are lots of ways that nature grips. The idea is how do we give designers these new patterns? There's a pollen grain. Julian Vincent, premier biomimic at University of Bath, says shape is cheaper than material. That pollen is using that shape to surf the wind to get up your nose. You know, it doesn't put a propeller on. It doesn't go to the Middle East to drill for oil. The energy in the wind is out there. It uses shape. And that's what life does. One of the most ubiquitous shapes is what's called the Fibonacci sequence, logarithmic spiral. It's what you see in seashells. It's what you see when you turn on the faucet and the water is in a vortex. It's what you see if you look at your skin pore. There's a spiral staircase. If I don't have a close-up of a skin pore, I need to get one. It looks like the Guggenheim Museum staircase, basically. And the reason that life uses that sort of a shape is that it's the way flow goes. You know, when there's a hurricane, the cloud is in that shape as well. It's the way flow goes. And yet, with our fans and our water-moving equipment, our propellers, we haven't used that shape. So a guy named Jay Harmon, when he put that shape, he took pieces of that shape he's holding and made fan blades out of it, and now has a company called Pack Scientific. And those fans are 50%, they use up to between 35 and 50% energy savings and 75% quieter. So listen, do you hear the fans in this room? There are fans everywhere. If we were to replace all fans with this sort of a shape, here's the one I talked about last night. This is the kingfisher, which has been mimicked on the nose of a bullet train in order to make it quieter, and it actually makes it about 10% faster and uses about 15% less energy. This is a car that is mimicked. It's mimicking the shape of a boxfish, small coral reef fish that deals with incredibly turbulent flows and is able to hold itself in place in the coral reef. You assign that to the body of a car, and you get great slipstreaming. And then they also lightweighted it by using a software that mimics the way our bones reform themselves along the lines of stress. Lotus, how many people have heard of the Lotus effect? This is the next Velcro. This is really going to be everywhere. This is how leaves clean themselves. This is not just lotus leaves. They clean themselves. This is a water droplet. You know how there's dew in the morning? That's because the surface of a leaf is not smooth. It's really rough. And it's got these little pillars, these little bumps that are a certain distance apart. And what that means is that dirt particles, that's the red thing, it's dirt particles. You can't quite see in here, but on a rough surface on the right, the dirt particles sort of teeter. And then the ball of water, the water balls up, and then it lifts off the dirt particles. So this is being put into all kinds of things. This is a building that was painted 8 years ago in Germany with this. This is called Lotussen paint. And when it dries, it has that bumpy structure, which rainwater cleans the building. Okay? And it's also in, it's in all kinds of things now. Roofing tiles, it's going to be in paint, car paint, auto paint, windows. The auto paint is still matte, but and fabric. Again, what are the ubiquitous things that we see every day and that we pass that have these answers for us? We argue about paint and paint formulations. There is no blue pigment in this bird. Life has a couple of ways of making color to your eye. One is pigment, but it's expensive. It's a chemical. It's expensive. Another way is just to change the last few layers of its wing structure to create the color to your eye, to play with light, basically. Structure is cheaper. Shape is cheaper than material. So all of these organisms are brown. It's the only pigment they have in them, every single one. What's happening is some of them are layered, some of them have little holes. They have all different kinds of mechanisms for structural color. The simplest ones, think of it this way. They're made, the feathers are made of keratin. It's like your fingernails, okay? And think of layers of your fingernail being transparent, and they're a certain width. And that gives it what's called a refractive index. And they're layered. So light comes in, and then it goes through some of them, and it bounces, and it starts bouncing back, okay? And it gets, a certain color gets amplified. Change the width of the layers, change the color. So here's a fabric that has no pigment in it whatsoever. On the left there, that has no pigment. So we're away from the idea of toxic pigments. While we're manufacturing, we give it a shape that plays with light. Imagine all these products never having to be painted again. Imagine your car being sort of transparent in your garage until you drove it out into sunlight. This is Qualcomm, who bought, who looked at butterfly technology and is making PDA screens that the pixels, each pixel has basically a little sandwich that it changes the width of the layers, basically, and creates a different color to your eyes. So the sunlight actually creates the color display. Another, you know, just there's a lot of things to have to, that have to do with the saving of waste, saving of materials. 300,000 fender benders a year is a big waste of materials. Volvo, the University of Newcastle looked at locusts. You know how locusts are in huge swarms, but they do not collide. And the reason they do not collide is they have a phenomenal ability to sense and respond before collision. And so Volvo, so the University of Newcastle biologists studied this. That's the giant neuron that's in the locust. And then they took that idea and they put it into an anti-collision device. And there's, I'm not going to go into sensing. I'm not going to go into computers or genetic algorithms. There's all kinds of things. I wanted to get into, there's some people here from healthcare. This is the Lazarus shark. Lazarus shark can survive for 3 hours without oxygen. If you did that, you would be so far beyond stroke. You know, that's what, you know, you go in and you have a stroke and they have to quickly help you or else you start to have problems because of the anoxic conditions. 3 hours without oxygen, because it's a tidal feeder. It's in the tidal pools. Hangs out, depletes all the oxygen gets depleted. By the time the water comes back in, it comes back to life, basically. It's called a Lazarus shark. And ER docs, they're looking at how to treat patients who come in, not with a chemical from this guy, but just learning a mechanism from this guy. This is a really, really important one, I think, in an era of superbugs. When you go into a hospital, you've got antibiotic resistance that has created You all know what that is. That's created superbugs, right? We just keep dousing them with antibiotics, and the strong ones survive, and we actually create an epidemic of superbugs from that, right? Organisms are surrounded by bacteria, including us. They're inside of us. They're all around us. The question for biomimics was, what in the natural world is surrounded by bacteria but has no bacteria on its surface? And this is some brilliant work, I think. That was done by Peter Steinberg at University of New South Wales. That red kelp has no bacteria on its surface, Botany Bay, Australia. What it's doing is really like an Aikido move. Bacteria, when they land on a surface, a few of them will hang out, and then they'll start communicating with bacteria floating by. Okay? And then those bacteria will come down, and they'll form what's called a biofilm, that slimy layer that you have inside. If you haven't cleaned your toothbrush thing in a while, that's biofilm. And that layer is formed because of this community. It's called quorum sensing from bacteria. What this plant does is it releases a molecule that jams the communication signals of the passing bacteria. The folks at Biosignal have mimicked this. What's interesting is you're not killing the bacteria, so you're not encouraging resistance. They just pass on by. And the ones that have landed, they won't form a biofilm if there's not enough of them, so they come off the surface. That's why that surface is free of bacteria. Hospital surfaces, contact lenses, the really important one for sustainability is to put this in an anti-fouling paint for boats, because now we use this stuff that uses nasty, releases tin and heavy metals into bays. This is a whole, in other words, it's a new approach to dealing with germs, with bacteria. This is another kind of holy grail in public health. Half of vaccines don't reach their intended recipients because at some point along the line, the cold chain is broken, meaning the refrigerator breaks down, refrigeration breaks down. So how do you create a storage device for vaccines that you can take a vaccine and put it in your glove compartment? So a guy named Bruce Rosner at Cambridge Biostability looked at these organisms. The guy. Anybody know what that guy on the left is? What?
Mite.
Good guess. Mite. It's smaller than that. It's really small. You could be drinking it in your water right now. Well, in tap water.
Lovely.
Do you know what it is? Anybody?
Water bear.
Yep. It's a water bear. It's no fair, Tom Lovejoy. He knows everything. Everybody but Tom. It's a tardigrade. It's a water bear. And what's interesting, what's similar about the tardigrade and what's called the resurrection fern is that both of these organisms are able to dry out, lose the water in their bodies almost completely, and then go into a suspended state of animation. And the water bear can do it for a very, very long time. The resurrection fern can do it for months on end, and it'll turn brown like that, and then you add water and it greens up again. But what's interesting is that it is a perfect storage device because in our cells, if we dried out, the sugars in our cells would crystallize and they'd get sharp points and they'd poke through our cell membranes and we would die. But these guys have a sugar called trehalose and the sugar turns to a glass like an amber. It's soft, like a maple syrup. Think of it that way. So it's a different kind of sugar. So what Bruce Rosner did was he took that sugar, he mimicked it, and he used it to coat vaccines in like a tiny time capsule coating, put those vaccines, and he can put 5 or 6 different vaccines, multivalent vaccines, into an inert liquid in a vial attached to a hypodermic needle. And it's thermally stable. This is an important technology. It's being tested right now by Panacea pharmaceuticals in India. But I think, where's the guy from WHO? Hey, do you know about this?
No, I don't.
Oh, man. Oh, man. I mean, you know, I filter feed for these case studies all day long, you know, all the time. And so I'm finding, but a lot of this stuff is small and languishing, but gosh, if we could just daylight some of this. Here's another one, malaria. This is the crested auklet who breeds in Alaska on an island that's like a tundra, heather, really, really wet. And the mosquitoes are in clouds. You know, you could, like, draw your name in the mosquitoes, right? I mean, it's... And no mosquito... If these guys were bled to death by those mosquitoes, I mean, their chicks would just... They would be bled to death, I should say. Not a mosquito on these guys. So what's happening with the crested auklet? And there's... That's just a typical biomimicry question. What in nature has already solved the question I'm trying to... That's work being done at University of Alaska. There's a whole... I wrote a whole chapter in the book on zoopharmacognosy, which is a really melodious word for self-medication. It's looking at animals that are self-medicating, picking particular plants and making themselves... And literally dosing, preparing the plants and dosing, and then following them in their rounds around the jungle and picking those plants and saying, is there a potential, what's called secondary compounds, is there a potential drug in this plant? So letting these organisms that have been pharmacists for a long time take the first cut and seeing what they eat. Very interesting field. Finally, at the level of ecosystem, I won't go deeply into this. I'll just mention that if I was talking to an industry crowd, a manufacturing group, they're very interested in this kind of work. On the left is a food web of, it's a picture of a coral reef. At foodwebs.org, they have these amazing things where this is, you know, eating, who's eating and being eaten kind of thing. But I just wanted you to see the incredible, you know, when poop falls in a coral reef, it gets used. You know, it gets used. And we need to start to connect our economy in that way so that there aren't landfills and there aren't dumpsters in the back. This is a diagram of what's called an eco-industrial park in Kalundborg, Denmark. And there are many of these now around the country. And what it basically is that the waste product of one company becomes the raw material for another company. And it's a matter of hooking up those information, those material brokerages, so that nothing's being wasted. So I didn't know who was going to be here. This is such an interesting group. If you are a company, there's an opportunity to train your innovators at a biomimicry workshop. Okay. What's happened now is that this is really a methodology. It's a problem-solving method. And so I've been talking to you about where it's gone from lab to product. Well, now if you're a company and you want to solve a problem, how do you take your problem and say, I want to reduce noise, I want sound dampening? How do you then find the best natural model, study it, or in many, many, many cases, it's already been studied. This is about pulling the literature and then finding a mechanism that might work and then developing it into a product. But we teach biomimicry workshops in Costa Rica for designers and engineers that are phenomenal. If you're a biologist, we also teach biologists at the design table training. We have one in 2 weeks in Montana. So we're training on both sides. We're training biologists to sit at the design table and work with designers and engineers, and we're training designers and engineers to begin to think this way and then to pull in biologists when they need them. If you're a designer, begin to practice this. We're working on... One of the things we realized was that... a lot more bio-inspired innovation would go on if the people who are making our world knew about biology. But they're not going to become biologists. You very rarely have it all in the same person. They're going to have to learn to get biological knowledge somewhere. So they go to Google and they type in a biological concept like, they type in something like lubrication. Now, in the natural world, the best lubricant really is at the bottom of slugs, you know, the slug slime. But in a paper, you could have paper after paper after paper, and it will never mention lubrication. It's mucin. You know, so you may not find, it's difficult to put in your search term and find the biological knowledge. So what we're trying to do with this biomimicry design portal is to create a Google of nature's solutions, in which designers, engineers, anyone solving a problem can go to the site, type in a function, and up will come selected articles about how nature does that, and pictures of Stas Gorb's insect feet, and then an expert that you can actually call. It's a way, it's part Google and part eHarmony.com for biologists and engineers. Because, Tom, you know, I was trained in the biological world. I don't know how the world works. I never worked with an engineer. But it's time to get us together. So this will be a collaborative design space. It'll be a place where industry can post challenges with bounties attached, like the XPRIZE. And hopefully biologists out there will say, gosh, I know an organism who does this. And they will upload their paper and their information. And teams will form and start to create new, more sustainable products and processes. There'll also be an education lobe of this thing, because right now there's 5 universities teaching biology taught functionally and then teaching a biomimetic design lab that we've been working with. And so we'll have all of their curricula on the web so you can take a class, and we'll have all the students' designs on the web. And this will grow because it's an open source thing. This is something that we're trying to get instituted. Tom, this is something I'd love to talk to you about too. If designers and engineers take one biology course, teach biology functionally. So it mimics their own engineering book, but it's how nature would do this. So, you know, biomechanics stuff and how nature pumps and movement and fluids. Biomimicry, stay tuned on biomimicry.net for all this kind of stuff. Our company's called Biomimicry Guild, and then we have an institute as well to do the nonprofit stuff. How did a nature writer... I'm a nature writer. I wrote 5 books on plant and animal adaptations before this. How did a nature writer get to where I am now talking with designers and engineers? I wrote nature books to increase people's respect and admiration for the natural world. I wanted to say, look at how amazing this is. And 4 people read these books, you know, 5 people. My parents included. And I'm still, biomimicry was just another effort to say, look at how amazing this is. And take your stance as student. What could we learn? And it is a way of creating new inventions. But for me, it is much, much more than that, because it's a whole new way of seeing the natural world. It's a whole new relationship for us as a species to the rest of, we are nature, to the rest of the natural world. And I've just talked about nature as model, but it's also nature as measure. What would nature do here is what we've talked about, and what wouldn't nature do here? And nature as mentor is, I think, a stance that we need to get to so that all good decision-making emerges from that sense of respect for the rest of the natural world. I guarantee you when you walk back to your car today, you'll be looking at these organisms in a slightly different way. And it'll be much more difficult for you to know that they're going extinct. That's the hope. There is still an enormous amount to learn. And these guys are blinking out as we speak. These geniuses. So one of the things that we're trying to institute now is a Thanksgiving piece. You know, biomimicry is about quieting human cleverness and then listening and then echoing what you hear and then somehow giving thanks. Because if you don't give thanks, it becomes another ripoff. It becomes another extractive technology. So what we're trying to do is say to companies that come up with these bio-inspired inventions, we're trying to ask them to donate a percentage of their proceeds to conserve the habitat of the organism that inspired it. And it's called Innovation for Conservation. And I have a feeling this is going to really possibly, I mean, imagine if Mercedes-Benz, Daimler Chrysler makes the Boxfish car. And if they put 1% of the retail price of those cars to preserving coral reefs. Because at the end of the day, you really do need to preserve the wellsprings of these good ideas. And it's good for us as a culture to say thank you. It's a good gesture. But it's also a very practical one to preserve the wellsprings of these ideas. Before I leave, I do want to say that life is not just a collection of different technologies at all. What's really amazing about these organisms is what they do in total. In ensemble, all the guys I talked about are managing to filter the air we breathed and to filter the water we're drinking. And to build soil. And at some point, that's our real design challenge. That's our design brief. Life creates conditions conducive to life. And that's the trick, that if we hang in there long enough and we really pay attention to these organisms, that's the one we have to get to, I think. Thank you very much. In some way, go to the website, biomimicry.net, and go to the biofeedback site and fill in what you're interested in and just start to get our newsletter and stuff like that. The other thing is we did start an institute because we realized that to amplify this, we can't, you know, we're a growing but still small group of biologists. How do we amplify this? And one of the main ways is going to be that web portal. And that web portal, we have a prototype now, and we do need advice. We need IT help on that web portal. We need design help for the interface. And we need some funds to bring it to launch and get it to a critical mass so that people will fill it. That's a really...